Clint's topic today is going to be plate tectonics and volcanoes, which is a really interesting topic. I'm always interested. Now that I've come off the flatlands, I'm interested in what goes on around here. And I visited Mount St. Helens, and it's just the most fascinating thing to see the results of what's going on under our Earth. So let's hear some more about that. Clint? Okay.
I'd like to introduce myself a little bit more. I was born and raised in St. George, Utah. And if you say it right, if you've been down that part of the country, it's St. George. And as my brother said, it's kind of well known in the state of Utah for having a distinctive accent. One girl had on television, she said, "Well, you talk about a gorgeous orange farmer. That's the way you're supposed to talk." I've been educated at Brigham Young University in resource geography. Got my bachelor's and master's there. Went to Oregon State University and got a PhD in range ecology. I've worked for the U.S. Forest Service as an area ecologist since 1975, headquartered in Okanagan, Washington, and I cover the Colville, Okanagan, and Wenatchee National Forests, which is virtually all of national forest land in eastern Washington, with the exception of a little bit down in the Blue Mountains. And I've been taking plots and doing data and writing guides ever since then for them. I'd like for you all to introduce yourselves. Now, I'm going to try and remember your names, but don't expect very much from me. If you had good botanical names, it would make life much easier. I see that they've put acorns on all of us, which must mean we're a bunch of nuts anyway. So we'll start here and go around. Tell me who you are and where you're from.
I'm Charles Mansfield, and I'm from Okanagan, Washington, 1963.
Okay.
Becky Mansfield. Currently living in Tigard near Portland, Oregon.
Oh, I know. I know where Tigard is.
I'm Sylvia Moen, and I'm a Californian, but I'm living in Washington now.
Okay.
I'm Bill Hayworth. We live in Santa Rosa, California.
Okay.
I'm Lydia Mayberry from Spokane.
Dolores Mangan from Spokane.
Not Jeep Spokane.
Jeanette Foster, Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Elmer Foster, Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Okay.
I have a good botanical name, Myrtle Hayworth.
Myrtle is a good name.
Okay.
I'm Carl Munson from Snohomish County in Washington.
Okay.
I'm Ruth Munson. Same place.
I'm Bert Priest from Spokane, Washington.
Okay.
Guys, in Utah, Washington. Jean R. Richland, Washington.
Murphy Soderberg, Moses Lake, Washington.
Eric Soderberg, Moses Lake.
Okay.
Jan Fisk, Moses Lake.
Ken Fisk, Moses Lake.
Carl Comer, right here.
Jeanette Heidbaum, Moses Lake.
Back there leaning against the wall.
Yeah, I'm Bill Belsich from Bellingham.
Okay. I'm not going to remember all your names right now, but I'll work on it. I have a few rules of the class. And first of all, if you can't hear me, raise your hand. And don't be embarrassed.
Pardon me?
That's twice. Second is ask questions. The only dumb question is the one you don't ask. I've sat in a lot of college classes and raised my hand a lot of times and come out of there always feeling like a dummy. I thought, "Why come I'm the only one that's not getting this?" And had a lot of other students who were in there with me go and say, "Boy, I'm sure glad you're asking those questions. I didn't understand it either." And so what you'll find out is if you don't understand it, chances are that virtually everybody else didn't understand it either. So don't feel like you're being dumb if you raise your hand. If you have a question, since we're here to learn, raise your hand and ask it. And get it answered. And I might tell you, I don't know. And a lot of answers, I use that one a lot. I'm familiar with that one. So go ahead and ask questions. And I'd like it to be informal and we just talk back and forth. Carl?
Well, I'm curious about your work. Is it in research or maintenance or monitoring or all the above?
Well, that's sort of a peculiar position. I work for Forest Service Administration, and the Forest Service has two branches. It has a research branch and has an administration branch. And if you work for research, you do research. If you work for administration, though you may do the same work, it's called studies. I do studies. The intent is to make a description of the plant community such that managers can understand what the implications those are and the environmental indicators, all those things, and so they can do a better job of managing the land. And with that in mind, I write guides and put on training sessions for foresters. And on my, there aren't any of them. Anybody here a forester? I can't use any of my forester jokes. They say, what about this stuff? It's very simple. It's designed for foresters to understand it. You know, almost anybody can get it then. But that's because I work in Forest Service. Nearly everybody's a forester except me.
Are those studies directed towards preservation, conservation, or multiple use, or what is that?
All of them. And we're going to talk later about biodiversity. And I want to define what an ecologist is. And ecology literally is a study of the interrelationships between and among organisms and the environment. It comes from the Greek, and it really means study of households, if you get into the root of the word. A lot of people have taken the term and taken it as an environmental context, and it has certain environmental overtones, but simply because one's an ecologist does not necessarily make one an environmentalist, particularly in the way that the world would like to treat environmental things right now. Much is being done in the news media, and all you got to do is go to the newspaper, and I read some of the things over there, and I kind of smile. There's one headline there that says, as humans send Earth towards extinction. That's a really arrogant statement. We're incapable at this point of doing that. We will profoundly alter the Earth, and we will profoundly alter the patterns, but we will be unable to destroy it. Try as we may, and as we are well on our way, the Earth has gone through profound perturbations in the past, more profound than we can actually anticipate right now, in spite of the popular hype. And it will survive. It may survive in a manner or in a condition that we will find extremely not to our liking, but the world will survive and ecology will survive. It used to be I'd see things all the time, they're destroying the ecology. They're not, because that is by definition a study of interrelationships, but they are definitely altering it, and they are changing it, and they're changing it in ways that perhaps you may not like, you know, that are not suitable for you. So I see a headline like that, I say that's a very self-centered, human-oriented, arrogant sort of headline, you know, designed to get people's attention, and does not really fully address itself to some of the principles that are involved in here. Recognize we're going to be talking about some very catastrophic events, and in nature, catastrophic events are both destructive and constructive, and we'll develop that theme a little bit more later today. Some people have defined ecology, and this is the one that people like to use against me, as the learned exposition of the patently obvious. And in certain cases, that's really true. You know, it's a lot of it is just simply common sense, paying attention to what's going on, and just looking around. And most of the people in the Forest Service call me a posy picker because I'm one of the few people that gets to go out and pick the flowers and get paid to do it. And so I consider myself to be very fortunate in that regard. With that introduction, let's go into some of the basic reasons why Washington State is like it is. Now, those of you that are from other states, you're just going to have to coast along. I'm sorry. But I don't know anything about Minnesota. Very little, you know. So we're going to go ahead and talk about some basic geologic patterns, because these are essential to understanding the patterns that are out there on the landscape. They profoundly alter the vegetation that we deal with, they alter the climate, and a whole bunch of other things. And so I'm going to go in through a series of overheads and talk about some of this stuff, and I'm going to be winging it. So if you want to interrupt me, go ahead.
Should I turn the lights off?
That's probably a good idea. Can you see that, or am I in the way? If I turn my head this way, can you see through it that way?
Why don't you get down under the table?
Okay. Ruth and I were here last year, and she can tell. She treats me with the disrespect I deserve. She's got some lint on it.
That's not true, is it?
Some of the major geologic regions in the state are outlined here, and they come from an excellent book, and I meant to bring it down. It's called... Roadside Geology of Washington State by David Alt and a fellow by the name of Hindeman, Alt and Hindeman. It's not a technical geology book, but it's excellent. It is accurate and professional and up to date, but it's not written in geologic jargon, which is even more confusing than some of the other jargon that scientists use. And I find it very informative and very useful, and this is where this most of these overheads come from, those books. And those, the Roadside Geology series are available from many of the western states. Alt and Hindeman have done several, but there are other people that have done them too. And they're available at almost any bookstore at a moderate price. And they're fascinating type of things. But you have over here a portion of what was called the Old North American Continent. You have a section here called the Kootenai Arc. We'll talk about that a little bit. You have a part called the Okanagan Subcontinent, and the center of the universe is just a little bit, 5 miles away from that thing called Omac, and that's where Okanagan is. That's where my wife and family are. I have 5 kids, one of which is in South Africa right now, and the other 4 are still at home. And my wife would be here, except that she had a conflict of interest. Her job required that she be where she was. That was a conflict of interest. The North Cascades subcontinent is here. Olympic Peninsula, Cascade Volcanic Chain. This is the big Columbia Plateau, and this geologic feature actually extends far down into Oregon and even as far as California. It's one of the 2 largest basalt flows in the world. The other one is the Deccan Plateau in India.
One basalt flow or multiple basalt?
Probably there's multiple flows, but it's one plateau. One considered to be one, not one source area, but one geologic unit. And it took place, or in fact, as you can see, buried soil horizons in between the various things. So there was a considerable break between some of the flows that took place. But it's the largest contiguous basalt thing, and it's overlain in various areas. See, it underlays the Palouse and things like that. It's really quite an impressive thing. And they don't know what's underneath it, so they've lost part of the pattern, you know, on the landscape as far as the other geology.
I stood at Hat Point one day, at the layers of basalt, and I counted 52 before I got lost in the stream.
Yeah, yeah, you easily could. Yeah, they're not even sure where the sources of all of those were, at least the latest things that I've read. They just think they were cracks in the ground, and it just welled up and flowed, and it must have been quite thin because it's relatively flat until it's been uplifted or something like that. It's an interesting area, the Columbia Basin. We're not going to talk any more about it. There's an outline here of Washington State, and we're going to talk a little bit about plate tectonics. And plate tectonics, I remember 20-some years ago when I was in college, the theory had come out that at one time the continents were joined together, and at that time they called it Gondwanaland, and now they call it Pangaea. And and I can remember taking some of my geography, my physical geography classes, reading some of the reviews of this particular theory. It was not particularly new. It had been bandied around at least since World War II, you know, but in the early 60s it was really starting to come to the fore, and people were talking about it, and I remember reading some of the critical reviews where they just really hoo-hawed it, you know, thought it was really a dumb idea, and now it's the rage. Science tends to be like that. They ride hobby horses at various times until those hobby horses become exhausted and go on their way. If they would look in the Old Testament, you'll find that there's a passage in there that says, in the days of Peleg, the land was divided. And if you study the root of the word Peleg, you find out that means division of the lands. And so there has been a record kept by God that if we would pay more attention to, we would probably learn more about the world that we live on, that He constructed for us. But plate tectonics actually deals with the movement of large pieces of the Earth's crust in what they call a plate, and these move in various directions. And when these plates meet, there's a couple of events that take place. A lot of it depends on how they meet, what their directions are, and where they're going. If you've ever looked at a map of the world you can see India, sort of a triangular-shaped subcontinent, is pressing forward into the Asian landmass, and the Himalaya Mountains are built from that collision. There's limestone on the top of Mount Everest, which means that that rock was at one time formed in the bottom of the ocean. And it comes from this plate tectonics and the movement of those things. And plate tectonics has gone a long ways to explaining some of the geological patterns that we see. If you read some of the early geology studies, I'm talking about studies done in the 50s, for example, here in the North Cascades, you'll find that it's very difficult for those people to explain why certain rock types are where they are and how they got there. They're really puzzled. It's quite a puzzle. With plate tectonics, Alton Hindemann make it very plain, and you can understand why and how, and it makes sense. You can see how it figures out. Washington State is part of the whole system that the San Andreas Fault is part of. We have the relatively small Farallon Plate, I think that's the way you say it, and it is being shoved underneath, being subducted offshore, off the coast of Washington. And because the Earth in the middle mid-oceanic ridges is splitting, and new material is pushing out at the rate of 1 or 2 inches per year, perhaps, and this is one of the drivers of these plates. And so you have these movements taking place, and we're going to talk a little bit more about those. But with that in mind, there are three major things you want to think about. I gave you this slide here a little while ago. Let's look at that one first. Where you have the North American continent, you have the Kootenay Arc, you have the Okanagan subcontinent, and a North Cascade subcontinent. We're going to talk about the development of this pattern here a little bit. But they have a profound influence because they relate a lot to our mountains. And this is a major physiographic division of the state. If I can get it up here. You have this area over here that's collectively been called the Okanagan Highlands. It actually goes over into the Northern Rocky Mountains. It's considered to be an outlier, or at least an adjunct to the Northern Rocky Mountains. You have the Okanagan River coming down, seeing there, and there's the center of the universe. There's Okanagan right there. And then you have the North Cascades, and you have the Southern Cascades in Washington. Pay attention to this pattern here, that the North Cascades are much wider near the northern part of the state than they are towards the southern end of the state. Not only are they much wider, they are much higher in overall elevation if you take out the major volcanic cones. But the overall base level of the mountains tends to be much higher in elevation. That profoundly affects our weather patterns here in eastern Washington. And the further north we are, the more we fall within what is called a rain shadow. But we'll talk about that a little bit more. The so-called worthless land from last century. It's not all that worthless.
Well, we put the Indians up there.
Oh, I know. We've done that pretty regularly until we find out that it's worth something. Then we move them off somewhere else. And we've done that pretty consistently. I was reading on the way up today on the boat about the Chelan Reservation, which was down onto here, and then they found out there was money to be made up here, so they moved them out, you know. And we've done that pretty...
Where is the big bend of the Columbia?
The big bend of the Columbia is right here. And the reservation used to be from the Okanagan along the Columbia, and then it goes up like this, the Columbia itself. That used to be the reservation. Then they split it because they found out there was gold in them there hills. And they have what they call a north half and the south half of the Colville Reservation. And the north half is national forest and private land and so forth, and the south half is still a reservation. The reservation is still over 1 million acres and still
That's all north of the Columbia River.
All north of the Columbia River. You come south of the Columbia River and you're there. The Columbia River actually follows the boundary of the big basalt flows, and they pushed it north and back and forth. And the river has been pushed out of its course by the ice ages and the glaciers and by such geologic events as that. It's really interesting to go down the gorge and think about that the river is older than the mountains, because the river is there, and it was there when the mountains were being formed, and it just continued to cut its way through. And the river will be here long after we're gone, and the dams someday will be gone off the river, and then maybe we'll get the salmon runs back like they at one time were. When I was a kid growing up in southern Utah, the cheapest thing you could buy, my folks were broke, was they'd buy canned salmon. Have you priced it lately? Goes back to the building of Bonneville Dam, you know. Looking at the state in that regard, for a thing about a year ago, they asked me to subdivide at least the eastern part of the state for some long-term ecological studies or long-term forest productivity studies that had been proposed. And so I whipped this together. And this is really much more generalized than it ought to be, but it will serve as some major breaks that we can deal with. Now, we're here in Lake Chelan, and we're right up along in here. And we're in a rather unique area because Railroad Creek is relatively low in elevation, and we're quite far up into the mountains, quite close to the crest of the Cascades themselves proper, and yet we have species growing right here in Holden Village that I've never seen over on this side except in this area. There's flowering dogwood and a few things like that. You got ponderosa pine right here, not very far away from silver fir, and usually those two are ecologically in much different sort of sites. So what you have is, with this low elevation pass, Railroad Creek coming over, you have the maritime air masses coming over from the west side and depositing quite a lot of moisture here, but temperatures never get really cold here in the village, and so ponderosa pine is able to maintain itself, yet there's enough snow and moisture for silver fir to maintain. And we'll go into more detail on those tree species later this week. Not just those, but some of the common ones around here also. On top of the plates, the continents are made up of granitic rocks, and most of the surface of the earth that we work on is granitic, or what they call a sial. This is a relatively silicon aluminum compounds that are relatively light in weight compared to other rocks which are further down into the crest of the earth. And so literally a continent floats on top of heavier rocks. And as these plates move, this floating continent comes along, you have this plate coming down here, and obviously when they meet, something's got to happen. So the heavier rocks go down underneath the others. Now, as those rocks descend down underneath, as they go deeper into the earth, they start to heat up, and about 40 or 50 miles from the edge, it varies somewhat, you will get sufficient heating and melting to where you get a volcanic chain starting to form along there. Look in your mind's eye to the state of Washington, and where are the volcanoes? They're in a parallel line following along this. So the development of those big volcanoes is related to plate tectonics and the movement of these things and the heating of the Farallon plate going underneath and heating up the rocks, and eventually they melt and things happen. Well, I don't want to talk a little, geologists get a big bang out of talking about hundreds of millions and so hundreds of millions and so forth, and they really don't know for sure. These are just relative guesstimates, and I'm perfectly comfortable with the relative guesstimates. I had a professor once that was a glaciologist, and he said he was on an expedition north of the Arctic Circle, and they found on an old shoreline a skeleton of a whale, and they said, wonderful, we have found a way to date this shoreline because we can do carbon-14 dating on the whale skeleton. So they took several samples out of it, and he says, I don't remember the exact figures, but the relationship, he says, well, the head was 100 and some odd thousand years older than the tail, you know, kind of thing. And they resampled it several times. The point is that he was trying to make to us, and I'd like to make to you, is these things are estimates, you know, and they are taking really very tiny things and measuring the amount of that and then multiplying it by some factor. And if they're off at all, you know, it gets really way off after a little while. And so I'm not going to give you a lot of time, but the pattern is here. The Okanagan, the old North American continent, is kind of along here. The Okanagan subcontinent at one point in its life was an island way out somewhere in the Pacific, because there's tropical type of fossils associated with parts of that formation. Through plate tectonics, at an inch or two a year is the average rate that they give nowadays, that subcontinent, that large floating island in the middle of the ocean, eventually came and jammed itself up against the old North American continent. The continental shelf formed off to the west of the North American continent had deposition of sedimentary materials, including basalts and things like that. This continental shelf, as the Okanagan subcontinent came in and met with it, was scraped up because it was still fairly lightweight rocks, scraped up, mashed all together, and that forms a geologic area they call the Kootenai Province, Kootenai Arc, which has a lot of marble, has a lot of other things. There's a lot of mineralization along here because of the heat and so forth. And you get a very complex geology in the area. But you have this subcontinent, which is primarily granitic, that developed. But then the Okanagan subcontinent kind of fractured in a couple of places, and where Republic is an area known as a Graben. A Graben is, any Germans? Anybody speaks German? What does Graben mean? It's a grave.
A grave?
Literally grave, or in geology they mean a down thrown block, where you have two faults and one block goes down. That's called a Graben. And a root word, I don't speak German either, but a root word they told me when I took geology was that it meant a grave. So Republic, when I'd go there and I'd talk to the people, I said, you know, you live in a grave, you know. Methow Valley is the same thing, it's a grave. Chihuahua River and the Chihuahuan is a grave, you know.
It's called Death Valley in California.
Yeah, it's a graben too. These down thrown blocks are there, and so that's one reason it's very mineralized, and there was an old chain of volcanoes along there near Republic, and that's one reason that is one of the major gold producing areas in the state of mineralization. So it has profound economic implications too, the things that we're talking about. Well, the Okanagan subcontinent came sailing in and eventually docked, and so did the North Cascade subcontinent. And they think it also was probably at least tropical for a number of reasons. One is the fracture lines in it, the Strait Creek Fault and a few things like that tend to run north-south, and they think that it kind of came up and docked and then sheared, you know, along the one side because the plate was still moving. And what you have forming where the one plate goes underneath the other is called a trench. The Okanagan River approximates the old Okanagan Trench, and right along there just outside of Okanagan is a place they call the Lime Belt. And I remember when I first moved up there, I was kind of puzzled as to how come we had limestone right in there and little outcrops of serpentine and things like that. And it turns out that was right at that contact line of the thing, and so it was part of that squashing together of the continental shelf, so we get the limestones and that, but it also pulled up some of the very heavy stuff, which serpentine is, you know, some of the basement rocks they call of the surface mantle of the earth, and it's in there too in small places. Serpentine's an interesting thing. You get a completely different vegetation that develops on serpentine compared to other areas. We're going to talk a little bit more about that later this week. But the North Cascade came in. You had a series of volcanoes that developed. All of these have been eroded away, and all you see are the roots of these things now. And you have the two major subcontinents that have come across. This area in here, they assume was a bay, but they're not sure because they can't get through the basalt enough to know exactly what's underneath it. It's just too deep. And so they're not sure what sort of rocks and things like that are down underneath those immense basalt flows. So sometimes they put question marks in here. They're not sure what's underneath. And then we still have the trench offshore that's still there, and some things are taking place. The Olympic Mountains themselves are part of some scraped up oceanic bottom type material. A lot of western Washington is the basement rocks are of that type, and the Olympic Mountains are still gaining in elevation because they're floating on top of something and they're still coming up higher in elevation, and they're a completely different structure than are the Cascades, and different orientation, different structure to them. Let's take a break. They told me the Elder Hostel people would fall asleep if I talked to them. We're going to go into the major volcanoes a little bit. What is the 18th of May?
St.
You're all wrong. It's my wedding anniversary.
Were you married,
John? We're all wrong. No, I was married a long time before St. Helens ran.
It's a St. Williams.
I thought it was real nice of the volcano to celebrate my wife's night with me.
Recognize your wedding anniversary.
Basalt is an igneous extrusive rock. It's dark, fine grained, quite heavy. Have you been to Spokane?
Just real few, yeah.
Well, you saw a lot of basalt. Those black rocks all along town.
Everything looked green.
Well, you're looking at vegetation. If you look at the rocks, what's some of the rocks? Do you notice some columnar rocks that were almost 6 or 8 sided? Right? Just as you're wet. A lot of that. That's basalt. That's a characteristic way the basalt will cool. As it cools, it forms that very large crystal, and you get these big columns. And they're really interesting.
Vantage.
Yeah, a lot of it. That's all part of the Columbia Plateau. It goes clear down into Oregon.
We call those palisades.
Yeah.
Yes. There's a lot of them.
A lot of them. And that's basalt. Well, basalt, as it cools under the right circumstances, will form sort of hexagonal or octagonal blocks. You'll see pillars, columns, what they are. When you get a whole bunch of those, you'll get a big cliff face, and it'll just be lined with it, like you go down through Grand Coulee Dam is a good place to go through it. Yeah, go through Grand Coulee Dam. There's just spectacular displays of that, you know. And these are basalt, but of course, various flows. And you can see breaks in there, and you'll see reddish stuff. And those are the old soils. So there was a flow, and then maybe 1,000 or more years, you know, to get a development of a soil, and another flow over the top. And in there they find fossilized plants, you know, carbonized and so forth, and they can get some idea of the ages on that with their carbon-14. Carbon-14 is a useful technique, but all of their techniques have a margin of error.
You know, one thing I'd like is an answer to, if you knew. We've seen a lot of these palisades at various places, from Lewiston to clear down through to Wenatchee and all those areas. Now, when you see an area that has a lot of palisades, most always, they will always be almost be identical in size.
Right.
You might see another, and the palisade part might be only half that big.
Right.
But all that size.
Right.
Why that?
I presume. I don't know. At first, I give you the answer that I give a lot. I don't know for sure. I think it's the cooling rate makes a difference, and maybe the chemical makeup of the rock, because the rocks that come out can vary quite a bit. Now, basalt has a range of chemical composition that they would label this group of rocks as basalts, but there's quite a range in it. And they're called a basic rock. If you go to andesite, that's a little more acid. That's more like granite. In fact, it's the chemical equivalent of granite, only it's in an igneous extrusive instead of an igneous intrusive kind of thing, which means that it was surface. Yeah. And then you go to rhyolite, which is more acid still, and it acts completely different. We're going to talk about rhyolite and rhyolite volcanoes because they're far more dangerous than are the basalt. And it's because of the chemistry of the rocks. Now, some volcanoes change their mind. And so you can't always rely on them, you know, to be the way it is. But the more it goes towards this acid side, which also includes more water, the more dangerous the volcano is because it's much more explosive. Kilauea on Hawaii gives basalt and is really not a dangerous volcano, you know, because you have plenty of warning, you get out of it, and explosions are usually not that violent. Mount St. Helens tends to be more towards the rhyolite side, more water in it, much more unpredictable, much more violent when it does go off. But Glacier Peak is much more violent still.
It is.
Yeah, its history is much more violent even.
Now, how long ago is since Glacier Peak erupted?
12,000 years.
I was going to say, I've been up there, but I've never seen
it. So 12,000 years. There's a little bit going on, and whether it will or not, don't know. Can't trust any of them. Occasionally one will go off that they didn't even, it was so old they didn't even know it was a volcano. Mount Etna was that way when it first buried Pompeii. They didn't even know it was a volcano. They have the power of life and death. And they built this part of the world, and they will change it. And what St. Helens just went through 10 years ago has gone through many times.
Can they use basalt for anything at all?
Yeah, makes great fill for roads and things like that. It actually weathers to real good soil, given enough time. The chemical makeup, it is that. Fact is, the island of Java in Indonesia has the highest population density of any place in the world, and has very high fertility, and it's formed a very high quality basalt from the standpoint of nutrients, and so it's able to maintain its productivity, even though an incredible density of people. My brother-in-law was there, and he says, he'd show us slides, and he said, you wouldn't see people crawling all over the place. He said, because they'd be living back in the forest, you know, and it'd only take a small plot of ground in order to keep the people alive, because they're very fertile. Many other islands are not nearly so fertile. And it goes right back to the basic geologic makeup of that and the way the soils weather out and the fertility of the soils. And so Java is able to maintain a very high productivity. It's also part of the Pacific Ring of Fire, and they have incredible volcanic explosions at times, or the Krakatoa is one. It makes Mount St. Helens look like a bird.
Another use that we call something serpentine.
Serpentine.
No, we used to look for stones to polish on a little.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you were talking about, or were you talking about something else?
Serpentine is a particular type of rock, and it tends to be what they call ultra-basic. And the calcium-magnesium ratio in those rocks, ultra-basic, peridotite, serpentine, dunite, are really distorted compared to what they are in most normal rock types that we regularly see. These are very heavy rocks. They tend to be deep in the surface of the earth. And so they rarely come to the surface because they are very heavy. Serpentine is an altered form of peridotite. And so when it comes out, it's a very hard rock, but it breaks down very easily. It's slippery. Soapstone is one of the other names of it. And if you drive over Blewett Pass, go past King Creek or things like that, there's serpentine outcrops along there. It's really weird stuff.
I know that at Fortune Creek Pass, which is close to...
yeah, yeah. There's quite a number of it. And then there's another place that I've never been to outside of Glacier, not Glacier, but Baker. There's another mountain over there that's got some. There's some small outcrops of it in on some of the islands.
It's also called olivine, isn't it?
Olivine is one of the basic minerals that makes up the peridotite. So
it polishes well, though.
Does it? It's already polished when I get it. Right out of the road cut. It's polished there, you know.
North of Andeyat on the Highway 97, there's a place we always call Ribbon Cliff.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, it's a granite, white granite.
Yeah, it's a nice.
And rather wide streaks of darker colors.
Yeah, that's a nice.
And the story was that an Indian warrior was killed a dragon. The dragon crawled along the face of that cliff, causing that stain. But I could never decide that a dragon could hang on with that cliff.
That's a rock type called gneiss. G-N-I... I can't spell it. Thank you. I'm a legend in my own time about my spelling ability. I was down a couple of years ago writing in the basement, and this is an aside, and I was writing something, and I kept yelling in the next room where one of my boys, my second boy, was. I said, Brett, how do you spell this? He'd tell me. A little while later, I said, Brett, how do you spell this? He'd tell me. And about the third or fourth time, he says, Dad, he said, and he's about 12. 11 or 12. He says, how could you get a PhD when you can't even spell? I says, that was not a criteria when I went through school.
Have a secretary.
Boy, I have a computer now that's got a speller on it, and I just used it, and I thought, boy, that's a wonderful invention, you know? But it's like using a dictionary. If you spell it so badly that you can't find it in a dictionary, the computer can't figure it out either. We're going to talk here a little bit about a stratovolcano, because that's what the Cascade volcanoes are. And a stratovolcano is, when I originally started taking geology, they called them composite cone volcanoes because they were made up of layers, like a layer cake. of different types of material. Now, Kilauea, which is in eruption right now in Hawaii, and if you've been on watching television, you see the village is gone, you know. Basalt flow coming down, wiping out the village. That's what built the islands. That's what I mean by a volcano being both destructive and what makes it. It makes and destroys. At the same time, it destroys our things, but it's also making the islands, and that's what makes it go. A stratovolcano, you'll get ash, you'll get all kinds of stuff come out. You might get some flows, you know, of rocks, and so you get this layering effect going up through here, and you have the conduit coming down to wherever it is in the earth. The stratovolcanoes will generally be much steeper in profile than will the basalt flows like Kilauea. And if you look at a big cross section, that's just a big smooth dome kind of a thing, or a relatively smooth dome. Very large, you know, but the angle of the mountainside is not very steep compared to Mount Rainier or something like that. You need to recognize that Rainier is only a fraction of its former size. Now that's impressive when you think about that. But there's a stratovolcano. They are the most dangerous because their eruptions tend to be very violent. Here's what they call a shield volcano, which is what we were talking about in Hawaii. Much gentler slopes made up of successive flows of basalt, a relatively stable type of thing, and not real violent eruptions. You can see great close-ups of Kilauea eruptions because you can get pretty close up there with the camera and be relatively safe. You cannot do that with Mount St. Helens. There were those that tried. I remember very distinctly when it went. There had been one of the Spokane TV stations had sent a newsman over there, and he'd gone with some guy they kept calling the mountain man, which just meant that he knew how to get around in the hills. And he was up there, the cameraman, and they had this guy's report. And the report, as he was running off the mountain, some of you from Moses Lake might remember him. Mm-hmm. And I remember him, he says, "I'm a dead man, I'm a dead man." He's running, you hear him puffing, you know. He says, "I'm a dead man." And he was certain that he was going to be killed, but that mountain man had him by the hand and was running down the mountain with him. And he says, "We ran by people that died." And they got out of there. He said, "We literally ran by them." Now, you don't outrun that ash flow at about 500 or 600 miles an hour that it got going, but the guy had enough sense to just get the heck out. He was running his camera and just running at the same time. And I thought, smart guy, you know when to get out of the way. He was lucky, too, but the violence is on a scale that we can't really begin to imagine. This is just a cinder cone. If you go to some places in the Southwest, like where I was raised, there's a lot of cinder cones there, and these things just kind of sit and do like a 4th of July cone that you've got. They'll just shoot out a bunch of sparks and spit and blow and so forth. And oftentimes you find basalt flows around them, but they're generally not that violent. If you happen to have one show up in your yard, you would think that it was not too good. But this is Mount St. Helens before the 1980 eruption. The way it looked, it was considered to be the Fujiyama of the Pacific Northwest or of the United States because it had a very nice shape. That shape was only a few thousand years old as we know it, that nice symmetrical cone shape. And if you studied things like timberline on that volcano compared to the other volcanoes in the Cascades, you knew that that had gone off a lot more recently than the others because timberline was at much lower elevation and the forest just simply had not worked their way up there yet. Spirit Lake had been created by a previous explosion of Mount St. Helens that dammed up the river there, but Spirit Lake had been created. Now these figures right here, lapilli, that's volcanic ejecta, ash and cinders and so forth. And they're showing the various depths that were in that area at that time. This is after the blast. The blast zone, some of you have probably been there since I have. I was in the blast zone the first couple of years after that. One of the ecologists that works down there took us on a tour through there. And that was a very impressive sight because it was like going into a moonscape then. Gray ash just covered everything. Trees just literally gone. I remember one of the impressive experiences was standing up alongside about a 3 or 4 foot silver fir, And you can see the mud flow had been higher than my head and higher than I could reach by quite a little bit. And most of the bark was taken off that old tree, but it stood out there in the middle of that flow and was still alive. And I was really impressed. And then we went out here a little ways, and we did dug a soil pit in a stand of trees that was still standing. And we found the same sort of soil pattern that this tree was rooted in from 300 or 400 years ago, where there had been a similar event. So what has taken place in 1980 at Mount St. Helens has taken place many times if you study the geologic history of that. And there's another book called Fire Mountains of the West that talks about the geologic history and in detail of these various cascade volcanoes all the way down into California. And they're really, it's an interesting book, and it's written in the same format as is the Roadside Geology of Washington. And so it's immediately understandable to the non-technical person, you know. They don't use a whole bunch of technical terms in it. Fire Mountains, I'll bring those down. I meant to bring them down so you could look at them and see what they look like. But when she went in 1980, did anybody hear it? I heard it. I was walking into my kitchen, just in front of the kitchen sink, and I heard a boom, and I thought, boy, that's a funny sounding sonic boom. And it was on a Sunday morning. I drove to church, walked into the meeting. A friend of mine says, hey, did you hear that noise this morning? I said, yeah. He says, that was Mount St. Helens. I said, you're kidding. You know, he said, no, I wasn't. Did you get dumped on? You really did, didn't you?
Over 2 inches all over everything.
Yeah. It's and recognize that that particular eruption of St. Helens was a small one, relatively speaking, to the big volcanoes and the potential. And so these are incredibly powerful events. Immediately after that, my assistant and I were in Republic, Washington. We were working on the Colville Forest then, doing some sampling, and we'd gone to dinner that evening. We were sitting in the only place in town at that time we could find to eat, and it was some bar. And there was some guy sitting around the bar. And Terry and I were sitting there having our dinner, and the guy says, well, the government knew for years that thing was going to go off. Well, I don't understand why they didn't go up there and drill a few holes in it and let out some of that pressure. And I thought, man, that guy does not understand what he's talking about. He's talking about forces that we cannot begin to imagine. So, anyway, the ash, this is an estimated ash fallout from the May 18th eruption of Mount St. Helens. And it covered a considerable part of the western United States. We're not quite sure how far it went up into Canada. And I'd like to emphasize again that this, impressive as it was, because it took place in our lifetimes, is not impressive as you start stacking it up against other major eruptions that we have. Now, Crater Lake far, far, far exceeded what Mount St. Helens ever did. And Krakatoa, when it went off, it was called the Year of No Summer. And there was so much ash and stuff put into the air at world's atmosphere that famine was worldwide, because there was literally no crops grown over much of the world that following year. There was that much stuff in the air, that much stuff in the atmosphere, to where it intercepted enough light that the world cooled considerably. And some people think that some of the ice ages may result from such events taking place, where you profoundly change the reflectivity of the Earth's surface. Krakatoa, it's in Indonesia. Yeah.
When?
1870 or something like that. I can't remember the exact dates. It was in the 1800s. People 50 miles away aboard ship had their eardrums shattered. And Krakatoa was small compared to Crater Lake, as I believe. I saw a scale once. I should have made a slide of it that showed the
tsunamis that were, what, 50 feet in height?
Yeah, or more. Yeah, then the destruction was absolutely incredible that took place from that. And it had worldwide implications and altered the world's climate for years. And I'm not being facetious when I say mankind yet does not imagine, you know, we're a little arrogant when we assume we have power. There is no doubt that we're profoundly altering the world's pattern of climate and other things to the negative. But let us recognize that Mother does some things too at times, you know, that are not always apparently benign, but there is a vast overall pattern to what she does and balances and checks and balances ultimately. But those checks and balances tend to operate over a much longer time scale than what we think about, you know. So there's a lot going on. Whoops. That's showing St. Helens as to what disappeared and what's there now. Definitely changed its appearance. It's no longer a graceful and beautiful cone, you know, symmetrical and all that other stuff. It's really an ugly thing now if you fly over it, particularly when it's been spitting a little bit and it's turned all of the ice and snow to a dirty gray color or something like that.
Reminds me of a tooth that's been hollowed out, ready for a filling.
Is that what it is? Well, the filling is starting to form in the middle, and eventually it probably will rebuild, and then it will be destroyed again. That's happened several times to it.
I flew over it certainly after we got there, because it's just like a big cavity.
It's a very impressive event. The long-term implications of that event are by no means over. And it's by no means necessarily through with its eruptive cycle. We could easily have another one, perhaps even more violent. There's just no way to know for sure. But they fully expect that it is going to be the next volcano to go. And just recently there's a news article where they'd ranked, one of the geologists at the University of Washington, I think, had ranked the volcanoes in order that they might go off, and St. Helens is at the top, you know, and then the others are further down.
No,
Baker's really quite far down the list. Yeah.
Rainier's
two or three. And the big danger in Rainier is not so much the explosion. We'll talk about that. We're going to get to that. Here's some more showing just the amount of material removed when St. Helens went 10 years ago. It blew off to that one side and really changed the face of the landscape out there at that time. This is a simplified cross-section of Mount Rainier. This area right here is its current shape. This is what it once was, if you can see that. Yeah, you can up there. So it was much higher by several thousand feet. That's what the top had been and everything. The great danger of Mount Rainier, studying its geologic past, according to the book that I've mentioned before, is not so much the explosion itself of a volcanic eruption, but the mud flows that will come down off of that, and they go all the way to Seattle. They run over 50 miles, and they are incredibly huge. They are mind-boggling. A large proportion of the population on the west side, it lives on those old mud flows that came off of the top of Rainier. And if it does it again, you can imagine what a horror that will be. And there is the real danger to the big volcanoes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. They'll come down there at several hundred miles an hour.
So you could
not
run it?
No. You have no chance, or virtually no chance, to evacuate from those. When St. Helens came and the ash and the mud flow went out at a couple of hundred miles an hour. The hot, superheated ash that came down on the blast zone, they figured that was something over 600 miles an hour, and are not sure that it didn't break the sound barrier when it went out. Now you're talking about an event just absolutely incomprehensible to us in our normal perspective of things, of power, of speed, you know, and of destructive capability beyond our imagination. The danger is real. Of a scope beyond our understanding. We tend to think that we're relatively safe, you know, and we don't have these problems, but we live in a geologically unstable area, the plates that we've talked about, the volcanoes are evidence of that, and that's something to think about. a little bit. People think that it never happened to them. You ever talk to kids? Say, hey, don't drink and drive. Never happened to me. I won't get drunk and kill myself.
But how do you measure Rainier used to be?
They go by the angle of the materials that are there, and there's a bunch of other things. I'm not a geologist by training, so I can't say, but they go by how the patterns of the various layers are laid down, the angle that they're laid, and where some of the mud flows ended up, and they calculate backwards, you know, how much steepness of slope to develop the energy to move that amount of material. See, Rainier and our Cascade volcanoes are covered with huge amounts of ice and snow. And when they heat, because of the volcanic explosion, this stuff melts very rapidly. And the volcano itself, because a lot of it is made up of ash and not really stable material, that stuff turns into kind of a slurry because of the heat and the water, and then it just comes, boom. And you're talking about Rainier's how many miles from the sea? And it's 14,000 feet high. It's not very far from the ocean. So you have really a tremendous amount of energy just from gravity to move a lot of material very quickly. And it goes very fast. The mud flows are immense that have come off Rainier. And therein lies the great danger to Rainier, is its size, its past geologic record, as they find evidences of old mud flows, the depth of those mud flows, you know, and how far they moved, and then the number of people that are now living in those particular areas. And so it has a real potential if it ever goes.
As I recall, a few years ago, the Mount Baker started steaming, and there was a lot of anxiety caused about what it might, how
right.
it might become. There was some concerns about mud flows there, weren't there?
Right.
Baker Lake, and didn't they make people vacate for a while?
Yeah, they. I think they did. This is the extent of glaciers in the Cascade Rainier, near Mount Rainier, about 15,000, 25,000 years ago. And you can see by the arrows the way the ice moved. And now the volcanoes are in a constant battle between being built up through volcanic eruptions and being destroyed by the glaciers, you know, that eat them away and tear them apart. And so there's a constant battle going on over a long time period of building and removal. The ice takes it away, and it's really a fascinating story of fire and ice as you looked at the shapes of those volcanoes. And but the water and all of that that's associated with it is quite a thing. Now this is one where they idealize what they think Rainier may have at one time looked at. At its maximum, about 75,000 years ago, Mount Rainier towered 16,000 feet above the Puget Lowland. Well, it's not very far from there. And you get thinking about it, the vertical relief between the top of Mount Rainier and sea level in a short distance is one of the highest in the world. Because the Himalayas are really a long ways from the ocean, you know, and you keep building up higher. The Tibetan Plateau is 10,000 feet, you know. So the amount of vertical relief there on Rainier is tremendous. Now, Glacier Peak is actually one of the smaller and one of the more hidden of the Cascade volcanoes, and I've only seen it from the air. I was hoping to get into see it last year hiking into it, but never got there. I'll make it one of these days. But it built itself up on a ridge, and Glacier Peak, as we were kind of talking at break, tends to erupt rhyolitic or very acid type of material. The acid material, the rhyolites and dacites and so forth, tend to be thicker and clumpier with more moisture in them. And the thing that makes the volcano go boom more than anything else is water that is trapped down there and superheated. It comes out of superheated steam and water. And that's really the explosive force. So the acid rock types have inherent in their chemistry a lot more water than do the real basic rock types, and therefore they are much more violent. Also, the lava, when it's very acid, like a rhyolite or a dacite, even when it's heated to melting, is a much thicker, gooier, globbier stuff than is basalt, and some basalts will flow almost like water. You see the Kilauea films, you know, you can see it really just rolling along, you know, like water. So they will clog opening in the volcano, and then the pressure will build up, and then it will go, and so it'll go up very violently. And Glacier Peak has been built off those type of things. And 12,000 years ago, Glacier Peak had a major explosion, and its ash deposition is found basically in that pattern. And you can still see areas of Glacier Peak deposition. Now, we're still underlain up here also by, this is 12,000 years ago, and Crater Lake went off Mount Mazama about 6,000 to 7,000 years ago. And so the Mount Mazama ash is over the top of this other. Now, most of our best soils in the mountains are formed in volcanic ash. They're not residual in place, but they have a lot of volcanic ash in them. And so it is both destructive and constructive. And it depends on where you are in a time frame, you know, as to whether it's good or bad, you know, from your perspective. And, but the volcanoes have tremendous impact in the landscapes as we know them today, and a tremendous influence through time. Now, just to give you an idea of what Crater Lake did, that's a Crater Lake explosion. And that was a big one. Incredible amounts of square miles and square miles of material blown out of that particular volcano. And then eventually the caldera, the collapse, and then you had the formation off Crater Lake within it, and so forth. And then Wizard's Island is another small minor cone that came up later up through and never really rebuilt itself. There's no guarantee whatsoever that Crater Lake is dormant yet. You know, a few thousand years in the life of a volcano doesn't mean very much to them, and the potential is still there for that to take place. Now, we talked about the plates. Not only do we have the potential of the volcanoes, but I was unaware until recently. I knew that the plates were offshore, but I'd not added things up in my own mind, and not enough of a geologist or to study that stuff or things like that. But the Puget Sound area is headed at some time in the future to a major earthquake, something 9 or above on the Richter scale. Now, the one they just had in San Francisco was a 5.1, I think.
No, 7.1.
No, it was not a 7.
Six.
I think it was 5. See, every point it goes up, that's a logarithmic scale. It's a factor of 10. If it had been a 7, if they would have got a 7, it would have taken most of it out. I don't think it got to 7. When the first reports were 5. 5.1, 5.2, maybe 5.5. And then they upgraded them a little bit after that. But a 7 would have really ripped it up. Something like that. Something in the 5s. A 7 is many times more powerful than that.
It wasn't right in San Francisco.
No, it was south of there. But I can't remember the exact figures. I think the 1912 one, or whenever that was, 1905?
1906. 7.6.
That was a 7, and that was really massively destructive. But when I remember when the one hit last fall in San Francisco area, in the Bay Area, people said, this is it. And all geologists are saying, no, it isn't. This is not the big one. And it's still there. But when they started ranking them and started talking about a 9, something in the 9.2 category being on the Puget Sound, I just, my eyes bugged out of my head, could scrape them off the stick, because you're talking about an event of absolutely mind-boggling proportions. Now, unless those of you from the Midwest feel real good, where's the largest known earthquake we know of?
Missouri.
10. 10-1 or something like that, they estimate. There just wasn't very many people out there, so there wasn't anybody to report on it.
Is that the one that made Real Foot Lake?
Yes.
Change the Mississippi River.
Mississippi's going to change one of these days anyway. It may do it this week. The rate is going in places. It's still flooded. There's still a lot of flooding. And I don't think it's the Mississippi that's so much flooding, but the potential for the Mississippi to do a major flood and completely change and leave New Orleans high and dry is very great. And in fact, it would have done a long time ago if we hadn't been messing with it. But when it does do it, it will really do it seriously.
I've always
always been intrigued by something I was told several years ago about the spacing of the volcanoes from north to south. There's Baker, Glacier, Gap, and then Rainier, Adams, St. Helens, all down to Hood, Jefferson.
I turned it off.
Down to Shasta and so forth.
Right.
In this gap between Glacier and Rainier are the Garland Hot Springs.
Mm-hmm.
And it was positive that perhaps that is an incipient volcano, which is struggling to be born. Have you heard anything about that at all, or make any comments on it?
I don't know anything about that. I would not be surprised, because it's obvious that the chain of Cascade volcanoes is still active, and it's exactly which one is most likely to go off.
So we could still be in a volcano building phase.
Oh, yes, very easily. Very easy, because we still got a plate offshore shoving stuff down underneath, and you have the potential of something building up sufficient heat and energy and pressure to build another volcano somewhere. And they take place still throughout the world. It's just that humans tend to have a very short time span, and volcanoes have a longer time span. And the scope of our existence tends to be in decades, and the scope of volcanoes is in hundreds of thousands of years, or at least many tens of thousands of years. And so we only get a very small glimpse of the whole history of a particular piece of ground. And if nothing happens while we're there, we make the arrogant assumption, because we think the world is centered on us, that didn't happen while I was there, so obviously it didn't happen again. It will never happen, or it never did happen. You know, we tend to have that attitude. Rexford Dobmeyer used to be professor of botany at Washington State University, a man renowned for his acid wit and cutting tongue, and also his brilliance as a scientist, by far the best ecologist that ever worked in the Pacific Northwest. One time he was in a graduate committee, and graduate student had been studying the regeneration of western red cedar. He says, I never saw any young cedars in the 2 years I was on my study, or the 3 years I was on my study. And Rexford Dobmeyer, since a cedar can live 1,000 years more, he says, what's 3 years in the life of a Thuja placata? You know, and I've been in meetings where he's cut people down, and I just said, boy, I'm glad that's not me. If this thing will work again, I'll put one more slide up there, because we've got a few more minutes left, and I'll talk in more detail on it, on the major ecological regions. Go back to one that I had earlier. Give you just a brief overview of some of the major forest types. I'm going to talk about this as ecoregion 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And this is East Slope Cascades, because my area stops at the crest. That's some other ecologist problem over on the west side. And the patterns are a lot different. And as anybody knows, the mountains make a major difference in this state. You know, there's the east siders and the west siders. And it's interesting. We east siders sit and grouse about the west siders, but I'm on the board for one of the state natural heritage things. And I was in a meeting last month, and most of those people live in Olympia, and they were grousing about the east siders, you know, their perspective. So ecoregion 1 is really goes over the state line, actually on beyond that, as far as an ecological region, and that includes part of the old North American continental margin, and I've lumped with it that Kootenai Arc that we talked about. Interestingly enough, relatively mesic forests are widespread. You have a lot of western hemlock, western red cedar, grand fir, Douglas fir, ponderosa pine, and subalpine fir. When I first went over there, in Oregon, if you're educated in Oregon, everything east of the Cascades is supposed to look like the Deschutes National Forest. You know, big old ponderosa pine with bitterbrush underneath them, you know, and beautiful kind of a thing. And that's all growing on pumice, which is a very unusual geologic substrate blown out of Mount Mazama 7,000 years ago. And so I thought when I went up to Colville that I would be dealing with that same sort of thing, and I got over there and found out that 0.1% of the national forest has got ponderosa pine on it, and the rest is in a lot of other. And I sat up there and I said, I feel for all the world as if I'm on the Siuslaw National Forest on the Oregon coast, you know, because I was looking at cedars and hemlocks and other types of things. So a lot of people, even in the Forest Service, that have not worked in that northern Idaho country and eastern Washington country, don't realize that those are relatively moist forests and quite rainy. You know, nothing like the Olympic Peninsula, because that's beyond comprehension, but still quite moist forests, and where you have those type of things. That entire area was glaciated by the continental ice sheet, and the continental ice sheet went to a little south of Lake Chelan, and everything came across. In the Okanagan Valley, as it came across the mountains, the ice sheet was at least 6,000 and maybe 7,000 to 8,000 feet in thickness, and there was more than one advance and retreat of the ice. Now, as they came down, they dammed the Columbia River, altered its course. They gouged out the lower basin of Lake Chelan on the way up. The one from Wapato Point to the other end of the lake was gouged out by the continental ice sheet. The rest of it, the Lucerne Basin, they call it, was gouged out by a mountain glacier that came down out of the Stehekin Valley. But the continental ice sheet blanketed that. It dammed the Ponderay River and Priest Lake and that country up to where you had Glacial Lake Missoula that formed an absolutely incredible interior lake. And then that glacial ice dam failed catastrophically. Now they think in the numbers of 50 or more times. Different flood events, and that's what's created the Channel Scablands, you know, the Grand Coulee and all that stuff. Floods of unbelievable understanding and proportion, and when Harlan Bretz first proposed that that was a result of major floods, they all laughed at him. And the geologists hoo-hooed and poo-pawed. For years in geology, they had always taught that what takes place today is the same thing that took place yesterday, you know, and they talked about uniformitarianism and all that kind of stuff. Now they find out that catastrophism is really a big deal, you know. A lot of things take place very quickly and very violently, and those floods were very violent. The amount of water that went down through Grand Coulee and that is incomprehensible.
Was it 50 cubic miles in 3 weeks?
Yeah, or less than that in its first time, but at least 50 cubic miles. The ripple marks are so big that they're difficult to be understood. And David Ault gave a presentation once, and I heard him. And he says one of the great things that he ever thought, one of the great observations ever made by anybody, and he showed a slide of the area, is for Bretz to drive up this road back in the 20s or 30s when he did it. He says, and observe that these things were ripple marks like you see in the bottom of a creek in the sand, except they are 30 to 40 feet high and 200 or 300 yards from one ripple mark to another. It's at a scale that is incomprehensible. He says, you have to get up in an airplane, and then it's very plain. He says, but to drive this road, and he talked about the road in Montana where it was, he says, and recognize these as giant ripple marks, he says, it was an incredible feat of intellectual ability, you know, to do that kind of a thing. So the continental ice sheet has shaped the topography of that land. The forest, the mountains tend to be rather rounded in their structure because of the ice overriding them and scraping and pulling away at them. The other portion here, the Okanagan Highlands, as you go west of Sherman Pass, then you're into an area here that is much drier. Remember what I said about the height and width of the North Cascades. As the air masses move from west to east, they're forced up over those mountains, and as the air is forced up, it cools, and as it cools, it loses its ability to hold as much moisture and starts dropping it out, and so you get a lot of rain on the west side in the mountains. But then as it goes over the top of the pass, the crest, and starts dropping down, as the air drops in altitude, it warms, and as it warms, its capacity to hold moisture increases, and so you have the development of what's called a rain shadow. And it actually takes moisture out of the soil and out of the forest rather than depositing it. So in very short distance from Washington Pass, and actually Rainy Pass, because going over the North Cross State Highway, you actually have a couple of major passes, and each one gets successively drier. Very short distance, you change your forest types entirely, to non-forest, you know, in a very short distance. The rain shadow is very strongly expressed through here, and so you don't have nearly as much of the more moist forest species such as western hemlock, western red cedar, grand fir, and so forth. They're rather minor components or even absent altogether. This one down here, 3, is really part of the east slope of the Cascades, part of the old North Cascades subcontinent, part of that rain shadow, profoundly affected by your elevation and how far you are from the pass, and a few things like that. Continental glaciation took place over much of that, but it had been first glaciated by mountain glaciers, which gives you the real sharp angles and the deeply cut valleys and all that. And continental ice just kind of came and followed that same pattern pretty much and blurred it a little bit, but never really changed this characteristic alpine type of glaciation reminiscent of the Alps. And the North Cascades are known as the Alps of Washington kind of thing, because, and it's a direct result of the mountain glaciation or the alpine glaciation.
Would you explain in the region 1, which is much more moist and has these cedars and so forth, why it is more moist? Because of the
good question.
Highlands there, the Okanagan Highlands?
Actually, the air masses, as they move across, will start picking up a little bit. There's also a pattern that comes up the Columbia River, it comes up this way, and it goes over another major group of mountain passes. And when I first went from Okanagan working in this country, went over to Missoula to a training session. I was impressed in Missoula how similar their forest types were to what I had right in Okanagan. But in between it's different. It's more moist there.
The mountains around the Clearwater, as you go toward Missoula,
they start to dry out a little bit more. And as you go further east in Missoula, they dry out a lot more.
But as I understand, the ice flow from the Missoula area also went down the Columbia River.
Yeah, came all the way across through here. It's called the Spokane Floods. Clear down to Portland, floated great big blocks of ice and everything way up the Willamette Valley. I can't remember how far, but clear up the Willamette Valley. There's a brochure that's available there at Dry Falls that's really neat. It's been several years since I read it, but they talk about how much was moved out. And we listened to David Ault, the geologist, talk about it. And he was one of the first guys that reported as being 30 or 40 or 50 different flood events over the years that have taken place. And the way he did it, there's some sheer faces. In lakes, you get deposits of very fine material on an annual basis, almost like growth rings in a tree. And it's called varves, and it'd be fine silty stuff, and those would be deposited. And every year, the changing of the seasons, whether it's frozen or not frozen, changes that pattern, so you can actually see these lines. He had a mountain climber graduate student, he hung him off the cliff with a piece of calculating machine paper from the top of the cliff down, and he made marks on every one of those on that piece of paper, and he came to something like 40, I can't remember the exact number. And then later they started studying clay layers down at Palouse Falls, and they came out with a number that differed by one or two, you know, something 49 to 51 or something like that. And Professor Ault, who's a great wit, said, well, he says, you can only expect so much when you're hanging off the side of a cliff, you know, and putting marks on paper as far as accuracy. But now they recognize that well over 40 different major flood events took place that came down across through there. And that's how they're able to age some of that stuff and date it, kind of thing. It's just beyond our imagination. I would love to have seen it from a discreet distance. And then you go on down here to 4, you're outside really of all of the continental glaciation, so you don't get the rounded summits and so forth that are characteristic of these two areas. And you get a very complex geology, because you're part of that North Cascade subcontinent. As it was pushing things up, you got Swak sandstone, you got Chumstick formation, you have serpentines, you have granites, and all kinds of metamorphic activity taking place in there. You get these gneiss is a rock that started out as a sedimentary rock that was layered, and then it's been greatly modified or metamorphosed by heat and pressure So the streaks in it are the various layers that used to be there, but it gets greatly altered. It's like somebody took a marble cake and stirred it. And that's where gneiss comes. And that's the Chelan stuff you're talking about, the ribbon cliffs. That's a gneiss, however you spell it. And then on further south, you get a lot of stuff down there that is related to major flows of basalt and andesite and so forth, much less mountain glaciation. The mountains themselves tend to be much lower in elevation with the exception of the major volcanoes. And so you get air masses coming from the west, from the Pacific, that are not nearly as modified as they are further north. And you see the width of the mountains is less and the overall elevation tends to be lower. And so we get more moist forest coming across than we do further north.
Is that kind of repeated as the air mass gets over the Rockies?
Yes. You'll see that as it goes over successive ridges, it will get drier and drier as you go further east, generally. This is kind of an odd one here because the east slope of the Kettle Range, which is what you cross when you go over Sherman Pass, is a lot more moist than is the west slope. And almost always the west slopes are more moist. And it relates to the pattern of air movements is different. There's also a gradient that as you go north near the Canadian border, there's a moisture gradient there that increases along the Canadian border. So I have hemlock and western red cedar. It's very common over here. Western hemlock scarcely crosses the divide between the Columbia and the Kettle Rivers. There's just a few isolated stands that we're aware of. Western red cedar is a little more drought tolerant, surprisingly enough. And it goes into several areas in there, fairly common, and it will be in selected drainages all the way across up here. Never really a lot, but you'll go into a particular creek and there'll be quite a bit in there. But you won't find any hemlock or very little. And so you get quite a change in your forest patterns of the major species that are going to be out there. And also the productivity.
I have a question there. The Palouse Hills have been described as being wind-blown soil.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Blows,
I believe. Less.
Yes. What anchors those hills that cover that part of the question?
The Palouse? The fact that it's windblown and it's either glacial flour or perhaps some of it might be volcanic, and those are angular particles. And Palouse, not Palouse, but Luss, characteristically, because it's very angular, will stand in vertical cliffs if necessary. If you can make a cut through that, it'll be quite vertical. And the Yellow Plains of China and the Yellow River is named from the yellow Luss that erodes into that thing and actually colors the Yellow Sea. And they dig caves and homes back into that stuff because of the angular characteristic of those fragments. And so it has a lot of integrity because each piece is abrasive and bonded to the next just simply because of friction. And so they'll be that way. And so those are fairly steep hills. Those are dunes. They're dunes. They do blow away if given the opportunity, if they're removed. And they're have greatly depleted the topsoil there. Now that's an interesting area because there is enough moisture to grow trees, but because of those soils, it will not grow trees normally. Between a combination of the very deep, fine textured soils will hold a lot of moisture, and there's enough moisture that goes onto it, but there's also a strong summer drought. So on a fine textured soil like that, it's always used to puzzle me. A tree can get started, but it can't grow its roots fast enough to outgrow the moisture deficit as the moisture evaporates out, and so the tree will die. And then also being heavily to grasses, they had periodic fires through there, and that tends to be hard on trees too. But the grasses don't care. You know, they burn at the right time of year. So if you drive up the Okanagan Valley, you'll come to a group of trees right along the road, not too far out of Okanagan. And they're growing on sand. Sand is sufficiently coarse textured that the moisture that lands on it filters down in and stays. It does not evaporate back out because the pore spaces are too large. So every so often there's enough series of years sufficiently moist in the spring for the trees to get started and get the roots way down deep into that particular thing. And so there you have a forest. I drove through there the first time in my life, and my wife and I were moving up. And we went through there right at dusk, and I could hardly see what it was. I said, I'll bet it's just like the Lost Forest in Central Oregon. And there you're miles and miles and miles from the nearest tree in the Lost Forest, and all of a sudden you're out in the middle of sand dunes, and there's a whole ponderosa pine forest out there. And it's because of that dune characteristic and the characteristic of sand holding moisture real deep. We think of sands as being very droughty, but in this instance, they are less droughty than the better, quote, better, fine-textured silt-type soils. And it is. And
the pine has a very deep
taproot. And so, and those things regenerate episodically. In other words, every 10, 20, 30, 40 years, you might get the right combination of events to where they will regenerate. And they'll maintain it.
Is that a favorable environment for cottonwood also?
If the cottonwood was ever rooted. But see, cottonwood doesn't grow a root very fast. Cottonwood, you're only talking about an inch or two of soil drought, you know, on the surface. And so it'll root right on these very gravelly riverbanks and so forth. But it needs that kind of thing, but it doesn't get nearly the drought. The principle is basically the same, but it needs a drought. It can't get too wet and it can't get too dry, and it's right at that tension.
You were talking about section 3 or area 3 on this, and also I was wondering, where are we located here at Holden in relation to section 3 or 4?
You're right there, almost on the break between the two of them, and you're real close to the crest.
And when we were walking down the road, there was a question raised about whether or not there was western hemlock around here.
There is.
Where I had seen it, I think, yeah, I remember one spot right over here next to Narnia.
Yeah,
yeah. I believe that's
it. Yeah, there's a hemlock over there, there's a few.
But we did not see any while we were walking down the road. And
if you go up to Heart Lake, and I know you've been there, Ruth, there's a ponderosa pine. It's only a few miles from the crest, and you're way up in the mountains. There's several down here. Right down here, I got a photograph where I've got virtually every tree that grows in the Cascades in that one photograph. Showing the landscape. This is a fascinating place. From the standpoint, you got all these things mashed together, and the fact is, it's very confusing, and I don't like it. Doesn't fit my preconceived notions of what's out there.